Hello and welcome to another episode of RARE's Digital Dialogue series. In this podcast, we're connecting with some incredible thinkers, organizers, activists, and food providers to better understand relationships to land, food sovereignty, indigenous rematriation, and relational accountability. My name is Taryn, and I'm part of the RARE Collective. For today's episode, Lauren and I will be speaking with Tiffany Traverse, a Sequoitmoc land and seed steward, farmer, and advocate for Indigenous food and seed sovereignty. Tiffany shares her knowledge and experience within Indigenous plant breeding projects and her reflections on rematriation, caretaking seed ancestors, mentorship, and many other themes. I love this discussion with Tiffany, and I know you will too. Enjoy.
We wanted to hear a little bit about you from you. If you wanted to just share some of your story. First of all, I guess, like, if you could say your name and pronouns, if you want to say your nation or clan or anything about your ancestry, and just how you identify and position yourself.
Okay. Rasquasri Tiffany Traverse, Sequoitmoc'ka, Slaka ta Sequoitmoc'kulu ta Chuchua, Mutka na Treaty 8. My name is Tiffany Traverse. I'm currently living as a gracious guest in the Treaty 8 territory, but my home is actually in Sequoitmoc'kulu, which people now know as the Columbia Valley. I'm a Sequoitmoc land and seed steward, farmer, advocate for Indigenous food sovereignty and security. We have a farm here in the beautiful Peace region in so-called BC, where I do a lot of Indigenous plant breeding, as well as I caretake for many different seeds that are not my own ancestors. These are other seed ancestors that have come to me through various means. Having the privilege of access to land, I feel it's my duty to be able to give life to these ancestors for people and then return them back home. So that's been sort of the embodiment of my life's work. My day job, my paid job, I actually work for the BC Wildfire Service over the summers. So you can imagine my growing season, albeit very short, is a very, very busy one with wildfire work as well. So I also take part in a few different projects. I'm kind of involved in a few different things, just with a huge lens and focus on climate adaptability for seed and plants. So I've taken part in a few different trials for the Canadian Organic Vegetable Improvement Project, or CONOVI, as well as some different grow up projects for Seed Savers Exchange from the US. I'm also taking part in a few federally funded research projects, which are Indigenous led. So these are pilot projects that I'm really excited about, because I get to dictate, as the Indigenous farmer, plot sizes, seeds that we're using, what do we want to look at, whether it's above ground, below ground, and then I get to dictate when things are planted. So I really wanted to go by the moon phases, which was taught to me by my mentor, Rowan White, and I really wanted to make sure that that was first and foremost at the front of my work, is, you know, utilizing these practices that I've been taught by these wonderful mentors, and ensuring they're really embedded into my work. Another really large project that I'm working on is caretaking for a very large collection of Métis seeds for my mentor, Caroline Chartrand, who is Red River Métis, like directly from what's now known as Winnipeg. So yeah, I'm really excited to be working on her seed ancestors and getting them strong again. She has a huge collection of seeds that, now not having any access to land, I feel like I'm able to, you know, bring the babies home here to me, grow them in a very similar climate and soil, and then return them home to her people. So that's a lot. I do also sit on a few boards. So I'm on the board of directors for Seed Change, and that's actually how I met Caroline. So it's kind of a full circle that came around there, as well as I was recently appointed to the board of directors for Regeneration Canada as well. What else? I was on the Advisory Council for Indigenous Climate Action's Decolonizing Climate Policy Framework. And so that was released, which is amazing. It's on their website. And I was representing, or am representing, the mountain forest biome, because that is really my home here in so-called BC, Secwepemc Kulu, which is a really large unceded territory, in what's now known as the Columbia Valley, as I mentioned before. Yeah.
Thanks so much. That was a wonderful introduction. And wow, I mean, so much knowledge and experience with me. I'm amazed and grateful. I guess building from all of the different things that you do, we're wondering what does the concept of rematriation mean to you? Or is there a different term you prefer to use?
Yeah, I mean, I personally like the term rematriation. And then for people that don't know, obviously, it's, you know, taking the term repatriation and putting a matriarchal lens on that and really focusing on how important it is for the matriarchs, specifically in Indigenous communities, and how important our work is. I mean, we are the seed keepers, we're the seed stewards, we carry the seeds and care for them. And so from a seed standpoint, rematriation to me just, it seems like a really lovely and apt term to describe returning of seed ancestors to the people which they belong to. And it's hard to say that belong to, a part of. I find them to be more of a part of the family, because ownership is definitely not something that typically Indigenous peoples label land and seed and food. I mean, we're all ancestors, we're all working in this relationship together. And it was actually Rowan White who introduced me to that term. And I just had loved all the work that she was doing in community and returning seeds to her community. And not a coincidence, because coincidences don't happen in my worldview, but there were actually some Tunaha or Kootenai seeds that found their way to me. And for people that don't know, the Secwepemc and the Kootenais, Secwepemc and Tunaha, are cousins. You know, we met each other sort of around the area, I guess, which would be now known as Cranbrook, Fort Steele area, people that know the area. And we almost killed each other. And what we were able to do is speak to each other by drawing in the sand and in the dirt where we came from. Because I think we each thought each other as the prairie Indigenous people, which we had some feuds back in the day. So we were able to, without speaking the same language, explain to each other where we came from, and became great allies, and actually eventually started intermarrying and became very, very close allies. And so to have these seeds find their way to me was incredible. I've been growing them for the last 2 years. They're absolutely beautiful. They look like a little chestnut Appaloosa horse. You know, they're like a brown bean with little speckles kind of on the one top side of them. They're absolutely beautiful. And I've actually been speaking to a friend, you know, kin from back home, to organize a rematriation of these seeds back home. So I'm really excited. This is probably the first time I've ever really said that out loud to anyone. And so it hasn't been confirmed yet when that's going to happen. But really, we wanted to make it a ceremony of the seeds coming home, and ideally do it right at the time when they're going to be planting, so that we can plant with the elders and the youth. So I'm really, really excited about that, to be able to actually be a part of returning seeds home, instead of just, you know, popping them in the mail or whatever else happens when we can't physically be with the people that we're bringing the seeds home to. So I'm really, really excited about that.
Amazing. I mean, my next question was, what does rematriation look like for you in practice? But I think you've just answered that question. But I'll leave it open if you want to add anything else. But I mean, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, I think of it as a homecoming. And, you know, maybe homecoming is not really the right word either, but it's really hard to think of exactly what it means, you know, right here in your heart, and using the English language, which of course we know is not exactly the best language to describe exactly what we're feeling and what we're embodying. It's tough. But really, I feel rematriation is probably the most appropriate term for it. But it is a returning to home, a returning to whether it's a person returning home, you know, by means of, you know, a museum, say, you know, we hear all the time about bones that are being taken back home. Like, these are actual, like, you know, people's bones. So that we're bringing ancestors home to be laid to rest where their home is. But seeds, it's the same thing. Like, these are ancestors. These are foods that have fed us since time immemorial. And to be able to have them physically growing and thriving right in the soil where our ancestors lie is a really important piece to, you know, that circle of our lives, really, to have those foods come back home, be a part of us. You know, we return to the earth. It's just a beautiful thing. Yeah. And to be a part of it, I'm like really, really excited. I'm really excited to get back home for one thing, but to actually bring seed ancestors with me. Mm-hmm. Pretty important.
Mm-hmm. No, thanks so much for sharing that. And do you see rematriation as similar or different from land back? I mean, obviously you've been talking about seeds and seed ancestors and homecoming. And I'm just wondering whether you see those rematriation and land back as similar or different.
Yes. So I think rematriation of seeds and rematriation of land is all connected. I don't know if maybe the same word would necessarily be used, but it sort of is. It's, you know, when you talk about homecoming, whether it's us returning to our homeland or seeds returning back home with us, it's definitely all connected. And I think our language connects us to the land, which connects us to our plants and our animals and everything else. Like, it's all very much interconnected. So yeah, I definitely think the land back movement, returning of land to be cared for by the people who originally cared for it, is a really important part of that circle. And I know a lot of people get really hung up on land back and what that means. And, you know, people are getting upset thinking that, you know, land is going to be taken from them and given to Indigenous people. And it's this really, it's a tough thing to describe, but I mean, it's all embedded in, you know, capitalism, colonialism, all these things that we know, all the isms, individualism, to think that land can be owned. And it's weird for me to talk about this because it's hypocritical almost, because I am a landowner. I own land here that is not my land. But, you know, talking from like a larger context of, say, like crown land that we call in BC, there's quite a bit of unceded territory that's this crown. But we're talking about the stewardship going back to the people who stewarded that land again since time immemorial. But then it comes down to industry and resource extraction and everything else. But yeah, roundabout way, it's all really connected. Language, feed, food, animals, plants, the water, the salmon, you know, everything together.
So Tiff, we wanted to hear from you maybe in a more kind of like, yeah, I think you've also answered this question already about values and principles of rematriation, but I think we could hear from you articulate that in a specific way around, you mentioned beauty. You keep talking about your seeds in this way around beauty. You've mentioned like connection and ancestors. And I think sometimes there's a sense that what we're fighting for in various movements is in a way it's like, we want to stop exploitation and extractivism. And often there's a big focus on like the no, which of course is important. So, and at the same time, it's not only about that, right? And it's also not only about bare bones survival, right? It's a lot bigger than that. So, and these are the kind of things I think you've been mentioning. So yeah, we just, maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the values and principles that are connected to rematriation.
Definitely. I think with rematriation, I think rematriation of land, seeds, everything else that we were talking about before is just the starting point for where we can see ourselves thriving again. You know, and you talk about healing, you know, it's and be resilient and all these words that get thrown around. The thing is, we are resilient. Like it's a difficult thing to describe, but I feel like all these like like the re-education around our language, it's the reclaiming. We focus so much on the bad and the trauma and the healing that still needs to happen. And I'm not saying that isn't there and needs to happen, but I think we also lose sight of our potential. And it's an old potential. Like it's that's a difficult thing to really describe. I think it is just really a reclamation of what we once had. And I think that really scares people. It scares people. It frustrates people. And when I think about values around what this means, like returning of land, returning of seed and foods and things like that, like my personal values and a lot of what has been taught to me and passed down to me, is the decommodification of, you know, these resources that we want to call them, you know, our trees, our water, you know, anything to do that's like, you know, minerals and anything inside the earth. But it's tough because we live in this capitalistic world. I mean, it would be nice, and it's a romantic dream to think that we can go back to our original solidarity economies and like a lot of trading and things like that. And maybe we can, and maybe it'll happen one day, but it is going to be a slow process. And as I was mentioning before, we're just at the beginning of what this looks like. And you'll see, you know, news stories where land has been rematriated to, you know, this tribe or this nation. And it's amazing. And I always get really excited about that because it means like things are actually starting to happen. But then you also look at the other side of things, how a lot of us are still within these colonial constructs of, you know, the Indian Act forcing us onto reserves, forcing us into the, you know, the chief and council system. And, you know, how is that land going to be used? Is it going to be like to our core value of growing food and hunting and fishing and caring for the land? It's a tough thing because, I mean, we're still stuck in that colonial system. So I think time is the only thing that's really going to let us know how that's going to look. But for me, personally, my values is, you know, I've talked to you, Taryn, before about this. I mean, I don't sell any produce or any seeds that I grow. You know, any type of money that I make from my farm is usually, you know, through interviews like this, or, you know, I have to seek grant funding to help with my research. And I did that purposely. Like I was really intentful on, I didn't want to commodify, you know, things or produce, because I don't view our food that way. So I'm kind of an anomaly. Even calling this place a farm feels a little bit weird, but I don't know. I think those are my values. I think when it comes down to what it's all going to look like, and it might seem idealistic and lofty and dreamy, but I don't know. I have a really hopeful, you know, view on what the future could look like. It's just getting there.
Just that small matter of doing it. Yeah, that's there are many challenges ahead of us, and especially in the current climate. I mean, it's always been this way. It's always been hard. And I think there's something about this time now with like accelerating ecological damage and the fallout of like so many years of commodification and generations of this. I guess we can have maybe some discussion about some of the protocols and practices that, you know, based on your experience are really important in the process of rematriation, like based on what you've seen or experienced on your farm or in the community groups that you've been a part of. you know, realizing those values?
Yeah, I think I can only really speak for myself personally and the work that I'm doing, you know, for example, with Caroline and her seed collection or her people's seed collection, and then as well with the specific seed of the Tunaha. Yeah, I mean, really when I got the seeds, it's again, it's that lofty, idealistic, dreamy, you know, world that I get in and just imagining what it's going to be like in 2 years when, you know, I'll potentially have enough seed to take back home. And now that it's here, it feels really surreal. And I think it's, I really want to use that energy of how important this is and bring that with me home with the seeds. And when I hand them to my cousins, the Tunaha, and like, for me, really, it's just getting the youth and the elders excited again about, you know, eating foods from the land, eating, you know, their, our traditional foods, as well as, you know, because you think about beans, like beans aren't necessarily a Tunaha staple. I mean, they were brought to the Tunaha, whether it was through trade routes or actually through, you know, commodity crops that we were forced to eat. It doesn't matter how, but they are part of the Tunaha people. They're part of their story. And I think that's really something important that I want to bring with me when I'm bringing these seeds home. You know, what else can I say about that? Yeah, I mean, as far as protocols, it really just is when I find these seeds or these seeds come to me and I'm, you know, researching them and figuring out, you know, whose seeds are these? I'm always asking that question, like, whose seeds are these? Because I know they're not mine. Like, whose are they? Like, you know, where do they belong? Like, where can they go home again? And then usually I'm just, you know, then I'm out there on the computer trying to figure out and do my own research and see, like, you know, who can I connect these seeds back with? Or maybe I'm not even going to grow them. Like, maybe I'm just going to make sure that they get home right away to someone else who's potentially working on a rematriation project or who's actually in community, who's those, you know, the seed, like, who they need to go home to. But yeah, like, there isn't really a specific protocol that I, you know, personally have. I know there's other communities that have been doing rematriation work for a very long time and are starting to, you know, build out some protocols around rematriation, whether it's land or seed or, you know, plants, animals, anything like that. Yeah, but as for me, I, you know, I don't recall of any specific Sequemoc protocol around rematriation, just because, I mean, we were mainly nomadic. I mean, we moved with the water, with the fish, with the berries, with the seasons and the migration routes. We usually had a summer home and we had a kukuli, which is a pit house dug out in the ground in the winter. But I mean, we were moving all over the place. So we primarily were eating roots and berries, fish, meat, you know, any kind of dried meat, things that would last and things that would store. So yeah, it's kind of tough to say what, you know, protocols would have been specific on kind of this side of like cultivated crops that I'm on right now. But I have actually been getting myself more involved with, you know, the traditional native species foods that the Sequemoc eat and have eaten for millennia. And yeah, I mean, like, there are plants that, you know, they have really low germination rates on the seeds. They take, you know, maybe 7 years to flower. Like, these are slow foods. Like, these are the epitome of slow food. But I mean, this is what we live off of and lived off of. And I think it's a really important thing for me to try to get to know these plants and seeds a little bit better so that when there are opportunities for me to go home and do work on the land, then I'm, you know, that much more prepared, because unfortunately I don't have the luxury of being able to go, you know, 13 hours south very often and actually stay back home and work, you know, specifically on the land. But every time I do, I get out into our, you know, quote unquote backyard, which is just out back the old homestead where actually my great grandmother and her family originally lived. And I get to go out and see what's out there and talk to my uncle and see, you know, like, what sorts of things have you been noticing that aren't here anymore, or maybe you're noticing more of something else? And so I think that is more like my own personal protocol, and my familial protocol is starting there and starting like really local, which would be, you know, literally like the backyard where I used to grow up, you know, and helping with different projects. One in particular is a nodding onion, or koala, we call it. And there are so many people that are tourists that are trying to get down to the river, to the Columbia River, that they've completely trampled down all of the koala. And so I was just, you know, talking to my uncle, and he mentioned the onions. He's like, yeah, we used to be able to get so many of these onions every year, and now there's hardly any. And he's like, I noticed like the patches are getting trampled down. And I'm like, okay, like, if you don't mind, I'm going to go out and have a look. Like, you know, maybe I can go up there and, you know, move some seeds around, or move some of the tubers around. And he said to me, and I'll never forget it, 'cause it made me feel so good. He said, you sound like grandma, like his mom. He's like, you sound like grandma. I'm like, what? He's like, that is exactly something that she would be doing. And like, I almost started crying, because I mean, to me, that's huge. And that's not something that I think is in my known memory. Like, maybe it is a faint teaching from when I was very small, but like, to me, that's an intergenerational teaching. Like, that's something that I think I just need to do this thing. Then I'm going to go and kind of move them around, if it's okay. Like, I asked him, it's okay. And yeah, he's like, that sounds like grandma. So that made me feel really, really great. And so I'm hoping that, you know, some of the work I've done over the last couple of years, even my family and, you know, our cousins will maybe get to go back out to those patches and harvest some of the nodding onion, which would be just absolutely amazing.
Thank you for sharing that story. It really makes me think about that juxtaposition between, you know, trampling tourists trying to get down to the river, and then also thinking about that intergenerational transfer of knowledge, and then your family going out to harvest. And that leads me into this next question of, you know, what kinds of responsibilities and what kinds of different responsibilities do different communities have in relation to rematriation?
That's a really great question. And I challenge different communities to, you know, to step up and to really help those of us that are trying hard to do this work and, you know, return seeds, return foods, return land. It's going to take a lot of effort. It's going to take a lot of people advocating. And I think we get too stopped up a lot of the times. I say we as like a general we, which I don't normally use, because of course we know there's no pan-Indigenous community in so-called Canada. We're all so vastly different in our protocols and our values and everything else. But I've just seen it, a lot of this lateral violence on, you know, whether it's people getting jealous of what someone else is doing, or jealous of what someone else has, and just really picking at each other and taking each other down is not going to help anything. And it actually really hinders the work that we're really trying to do. And it comes down to that, you know, that whole thing we talked about with land rematriation, and how is that land going to be used, and if it's going to be exploited yet again by those of us that are still needing to do that decolonial work. So really, I think that's just my challenge to those of us in community, is to really work hard at, you know, ourselves, and looking at, you know, what are ways that we can help each other out and lift each other up in the work that we're doing. Because it's absolutely exhausting. And I know you both know it as well, like, to be doing this work it's really heart heavy. It's really body heavy. It takes a lot of brain power, it takes a lot of energy, and to have people working against you it just makes it that much harder. So I think that is my challenge to other communities. But then also to ourselves, you know, we were speaking before, just before the interview, about this saying no, which is really hard, because I think we find ourselves in crises and overlapping crises with everything that's happening in the world today, with, you know, between pandemics and climate crises and, you know, unrest, you know, and our Indigenous peoples being criminalized continually. It's, yeah, I think there needs to be ways in which we can help each other and, you know, distribute this work in the best way that we can. And I mean, I'm guilty of it, of saying yes, 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 and taking on a lot. Because I have that anxiety of, you know, we need to do this, we need to, you know, do this thing or return this seed or grow this out. And, you know, it's that compounding anxiety is really not good for our causes either. So, yeah, in speaking about how we took all, you know, each of us took our rest over this holiday season, I think is really important. And that's a huge act of resistance to that colonial capitalist structure that is always against us, you know, that grind culture, having to just go and put our name out there and all that kind of stuff. And it's tough because of course we want to get recognized for the hard work that we're doing. But I think there's ways that we can be starting to bring more people in to help with just the sheer amount of workload that there is involved in this work. So.
Yeah. And I really appreciate you bringing up, you know, some of the like institutional challenges and barriers and in our societies, which are premised on, you know, colonialism, white supremacy, capitalism, patriarchy. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more in terms of, you know, addressing and challenging and tearing down some of those institutional barriers and structures. We talked a little bit about it before the interview. And I'm just wondering if you wanted to revisit that thought again, because I appreciated you bringing it up.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Again, I can really only speak from my personal experience with the work that I'm doing. But yeah, again, you know, I don't get paid for the work I do unless I'm, you know, I'm teaching, you know, holding a workshop, doing an interview, or applying for funding, which we all know that any grant funding application process is just so ridiculous. Definitely highly colonial, definitely very competitive. And I think that in itself is probably one small way in which we can start to challenge those systems, is how philanthropy works, and how can nonprofits and charitable organizations do better to not be, you know, helping or throwing money at projects and in, you know, specifically Indigenous communities, but really to form different relationships and form different partnerships that may, you kind of go against that colonial, you know, grant funding with like reporting and all these different things that really inhibit the actual on the ground work. And if that means, you know, maybe getting settler allies, you know, doing that specific part of the work on behalf of the Indigenous organizations so that they can be focusing on community work, or maybe it looks like a completely different funding structure altogether that doesn't involve having to apply for different grants. And maybe it's what can be referred to in different NGOs is like a fiscal sponsorship setup. And I've been exposed to that a little bit with my work at Seed Change, and I won't go into too much details about that, but I think there are different ways that we can, as you know, settlers, settler organizations, settler-led organizations, get out of the way of, you know, Indigenous and BIPOC community organizations, and really just, you know, provide what these organizations need to do the work, and not bog down in all this paperwork and reporting and things like that. And I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. But I think there are ways that we can start really looking at that system a little bit more deeply. Because, I mean, unfortunately, like I said, we're not going to get rid of capitalism overnight. We definitely need money and we need resources to be able to do this work. And I think those are just some small ways in which settler allies and organizations can do that.
Nicely said. Needed to be said. Maybe this is shifting gears a little bit, although it's all connected. I wanted to hear what you think about rematriation and food sovereignty, and what's the relationship between some of the work you're doing on rematriation around the seeds, for example, or in other areas, and food sovereignty as you understand it.
Yeah, I really love that question because the terms get thrown around quite a bit, you know, food sovereignty, food security, seed sovereignty. And what does that actually mean? And, you know, as I was talking before about the Tinaja beans and wanting to, you know, in the right way, bring them home to the people. Well, it's not just as simple as bringing beans home and dropping them off on someone's doorstep and being like, okay, here you go. Here's your ancestors. Ciao. It really is this holistic approach to teaching and knowledge sharing and knowledge transfer, but then also learning like the other way as well. I think people are too, you know, too much in their heads about one-way mentorship. For me personally, the people that I've been learning from the most are all people that are younger than me. And I really think that if we don't have mentors or people that we are, you know, doing knowledge transfer, knowledge sharing with that are younger, if we don't have people that are younger than us that we're doing that with, I think that's an absolute disservice. I mean, it's almost like saying I'm just going to keep growing the same seed in the same conditions. Like, how are we going to adapt and grow alongside each other if we're not learning from each other? So, yeah, I just wanted to put that out there. But as far as, yeah, food sovereignty and seed sovereignty, this is a really important thing because it doesn't look the same for every one or every community. And of course, I have to speak from the Indigenous community lens personally. We're all so different and our foods are so different and our preparations of these foods are really different. So there is no one way to do or to actualize food sovereignty. And of course, you have to have the people that are, you know, they have the appetite to do it as well. It's like I said, you know, if I come home with these beans and no one wants to do anything with them, well, you know, then it's going to require more conversation and more teachings and seeing like, okay, like, you know, where might we grow them this year? Who's going to store them? Like, there's so many different things that, that need to be considered when we're talking about, you know, literal food sovereignty. And then also on the flip side with, you know, the native species of like our like true traditional foods in Tsleil-Waututh, it's the same thing, you know, who's going to take over for me when I either can't or, you know, or I'm gone. And I guess that comes down to as well, looping back to Caroline seeds, you know, who's going to care for Caroline seeds once I can't, you know. We got to start being able to bring more people in to start doing this work and sharing the knowledge. And that's just how things have worked forever. No one was ever meant to do this all by themselves because our time here is, you know, we're going to be returning to the earth. So someone else is going to have to pick up that work and learn and then teach. So that's another part of the work that I'm really trying to look at is, like a succession planning of basically of seed sovereignty. How, you know, what is that going to look like over time? Because what it means is that we need, like me now personally, I need to get somebody else on board to start learning so what I've been taught, you know, and transfer that knowledge over to the next generation. But in that lies a lot of what ifs and a lot of questions and a lot of trust issues. Like, I have to be completely honest, you know, Caroline's been burnt in the past before having her research and seeds taken and then people turning around and starting their own seed companies. And, you know, where's her support? So it's definitely still a very extractive process. And it's one that it needs to be approached with a very, not a necessarily critical eye, but a very cautious eye, because you know, you have to have somebody that you can actually entrust with doing this work and doing it in the values that you were taught. Like, I'm doing this work with Caroline's ancestors the way that she has taught me and the way that her elders had taught her. And this is part of the story that will live with these seeds now forever if we're able to keep, you know, passing this down. So yeah, I think there's a lot more involved in seed sovereignty and seed security and food sovereignty that people just don't quite fully understand. I mean, people are starting to actualize it now, but it's yeah, there's really a lot involved. And of course, unfortunately, a lot of trust issues and commodification of the work that we're, you know, so tirelessly doing basically in our free time. Yeah, it's tough.
I, again, just want to thank you for bringing up so many, telling us some great stories and also bringing up some really important questions. And I know for me, some of those questions that really stuck out was even just those very simple questions of whose seeds are they? Who do they belong to? How can we get them home again? And I really appreciate your stories of how you're working to do that and working in relation to those seeds and to different seeds. Yeah, so I wanted to say thank you, but I also wanted to, I guess, just ask you if you have any other thoughts or questions that you want to add before we say a final thank you and goodbye.
No, I don't really think I have a whole lot more to add. I just grateful that you brought me in to talk a bit about sort of my past, my ancestors and kind of the way that they used to do things. And I'm really hoping that you know, more and more people, even just hearing this, can be inspired to really look into their own ancestral food ways and their own ancestral seed ancestors and really like seek them out and grow them and taste them again and get excited about, you know, saving them and adapting to our changing climates. I think that's a really important piece to this kind of chaotic puzzle is being reunited with those foods again.
Yes, so we know when Tiffany comes by with a big bag of beans and we know what to do. We know how to cook them or whether to plant them and when, and there's so much knowledge there, and I really appreciate you sharing your knowledge. I feel like I was transported into a different world for a time here, and I really appreciate that world that you're bringing forward and defending and protecting and celebrating in so many ways in all of what you do. So thanks for doing this interview. I also want to flag that's that metaphor, the seed as a metaphor around the mentorship as adaptation. That's really beautiful. If you ever wanted to write something about that or talk about it more, I'd be happy to, you know, read or be involved in some way. I think it's something that I've been thinking about a lot in relation to my work, the need to not be just myself, just me doing these things, but and not even just teaching either in this way that's like what I've been socialized to think is teaching, but really sharing, creating, I guess, an environment or creating relationships where that sharing is free and like back and forth and as like horizontal and also in acknowledged, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, thanks so much. We really, and I'm looking forward to future learning and future collaborations, hopefully. So thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this discussion. If you liked what you heard today, check out some of our other digital dialogues, which can be found on our website and wherever you get your podcasts. A big thank you to Tiffany for offering her thoughts, experiences, and wisdom with us. Another big thank you to my dear friends and fellow RARE Collective members, Sarah Rotz, Lauren Kepkowitz, Danielle Busno, Adrienne Licker-Xavier, and Ayla Fenton. And thank you to our research assistants, past and present, including Stephanie Morningstar, Sonia Hill, Jessica Ross, and Jaron Richards. We'd also like to thank the National Farmers Union Indigenous Solidarity Working Group for their ongoing collaboration, as well as the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council for their funding support. That's all for today's episode. Thanks for listening.